This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, March 28th. We're discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, and we'll hear from CAI's Gilda Geist. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Something happened this week, an upbeat, transformational event that many people thought they would never see, or perhaps not in their lifetimes. Yes, we are talking about South Coast Rail departing the station connecting New Bedford and Fall River with Boston and points in between. CAI's Jeanette Barnes was at the historic opening of a rail service. She joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
This happened on Monday, and not to build too much drama here, but even on the Friday before, there was still a sign-off missing from the federal government, which might have prevented the opening from happening or at least delayed it.
That's right. There's an agency called the Federal Railroad Administration, and they had approved almost everything they needed to, really the big things, except for this one item remaining, which was a plan for speed limits along the route. The maximum speed for South Coast Rail is 79 miles per hour, but normally a route has areas where that limit would be reduced based on the conditions. And not until mid-afternoon Friday did we get confirmation from the state that that speed limit plan had actually been approved that same day on Friday. Even though at that point, you know, we already knew the Monday was the opening. The details of the celebration had gone out 2 days earlier. It was close. Even though the state had been saying all along that they didn't expect a problem, it definitely created some suspense about whether it would really happen on time.
Yes. Everyone looking at Washington these days wondering whether things get done kind of as they've been promised or at the timetable that they've been expected. But this one came together. South Coast Rail, a long time coming. We talked about it last week. But for anyone who missed it, briefly, give us the big picture overview. Why is this such a big deal for the South Coast and really an opportunity for folks on the Cape, too?
Yeah, well, trains were something that the South Coast actually lost at one point. They used to have trains to Boston until the late 1950s. And state officials have been trying to reestablish this. Actually, multiple generations of state officials, you could say, have been trying to reestablish train service for about 35 years. They had to upgrade the tracks. They had to build six new stations. It cost about $1 billion. And as you said, it is considered a real opportunity for more mobility, for easier mobility in both directions, both, you know, folks from down here going toward Boston and then for people closer to Boston traveling to the South Coast, maybe for tourism, maybe for other reasons. And you asked about the Cape. I would say people on the Cape now have more potential departure points, although it may be more efficient for them to still sort of go northwest and get on the train in Middleborough for those who are already doing that. But one interesting point for fans of a potential future Cape Cod commuter rail is that this was essentially a prerequisite for that. The Cape Rail study in 2021 assumed that South Coast Rail Phase 1 would come first. So this could be a jumping off point for some more advocacy around train service on Cape Cod, although, as we have seen, it is a very long process.
Let's jump now to Monday of this week, and they have all the sign-offs in hand on this now, and you head to Fall River to ride this train for the first time. Why did you start in Fall River?
Well, the state officials were planning to kind of split the fanfare and ride from both Fall River and New Bedford, but Fall River kind of got top billing because that's where Governor Maura Healey was boarding. Also, the general manager of the MBTA, Phil Eng, was riding with her, so we opted to go to Fall River. New Bedford had the lieutenant governor and the transportation secretary, and of course, both cities also had their mayors, state legislators, and so on, riding from their stations. So the plan for the morning was for them to ride in the 10 o'clock hour up to East Taunton, and then have a celebration there.
And what was the scene like in Fall River when you got there? Trains are running for the first time out of this station.
Yes. Well, for starters, it was raining and cold, so people were trying to gather underneath the overhang. There was a small crowd there, like we said, mostly politicians, their staff, MBTA people, and of course the media. But there were people, several people from the general public who came out to ride the train on the first day. So people were waiting around. Then as soon as the governor arrived, there was a ribbon cutting in front of the platform, some speeches, and then right away the train showed up.
So the weather not really cooperating with the celebratory feeling there, but the effort going on. After the ribbon cutting there at the Fall River Station, everyone piles onto the train. You've got politicians, plenty of folks from the press, and you've also got some local folks who just wanted to ride along.
Yes. So on the ride is where I met some interesting people. One of them was Nathan Wing and his mom. Nathan is 11, and he loves trains so much that his mom let him skip school for this, which is pretty cool. So, you know, he just said he's always wanted to ride trains, really loves them. His mom, Jennifer Wing, is a big supporter of public transit. So this was kind of up her alley, too. And in fact, she decided that they were going to take a ride share from their house in Swansea just to kind of see what it would be like to do this whole thing without their own car. I also met some interesting people right on the Fall River platform before we left. One of them was Ali Kudo from Fall River. He said he used to go, the train used to go by his schoolyard in the 1950s when he was a kid, and he really missed it. He was kind of wistful about that whole thing, but he was happy.
Someone else that you spoke to, a couple, were just heading to Boston for breakfast for the novelty of it.
That's right. This was sort of a wife talked the husband into it scenario. This couple, they live right near the train. They can easily hear it from their house. But the wife, her name is Griselle Negron Stanley. She really wanted to try it out. So she convinced her husband, Ron Stanley, to go all the way to Boston for breakfast, although it was probably brunch by the time they got there. And they did not even have a restaurant picked out. But like you said, they liked the novelty of it. And a lot of people were sharing those kinds of stories throughout the day about either why they were riding the train on the first day or what it meant to them. When we got to East Taunton and we were waiting for the larger celebration to start, I talked with Fall River State Representative Carol Fiola for a bit. And she also shared some of those stories of first day riders on the train.
And we've got that tape. Let's hear it.
I rode the first train out of Fall River this morning at 5:05, and I was surprised and interested to see how many people were on and who they were, why they were taking the train. So we had one gentleman who grew up in Fall River and now lives in Worcester. He came just for the ride, the first ride. A mother and son of a high schooler who were going to visit Suffolk as a college search. But for the train, I think it would have been really difficult for her to think about driving there. And so it was wonderful to see how excited they were.
So that's State Representative Carol Fiola talking about some of the first-time riders on the train. And you can hear an orchestra. It turns out it's a high school band playing, and we're going to explain that in a minute. When this train pulled into East Taunton, this is where the tracks from Fall River converge with the New Bedford line. The governor gets off, meets with a lieutenant governor who's come up from New Bedford and with lots of other dignitaries, and they hold one more celebration. This is where the band comes in. Explain what happened, Jeanette.
Yes, this was the main event. It was under a very large tent. And as you could hear there, that was the Taunton High School Wind Symphony, which is kind of a lofty name. And I have to say, they really lived up to it. So shout out to them. That sounded great. So the band was playing. Many of the dignitaries had seats on the stage for this event. Of course, the mayors, the transportation officials, the governor and lieutenant governor. They got to kind of dispense with the ribbon cutting because that had been done earlier. So they went right ahead and talked about kind of the meaning of this opening. They thanked all the people who had been involved, recognized their work, and so on.
Well, what did they say? What were some of the takeaway messages from all of this?
Well, Governor Healey said that this really has meaning for the whole state because it shows, as she put it, that Massachusetts can do hard things, things that are transformative for the state. And I would also say it seemed like one of the takeaways here is that this is kind of a score for persistence and patience in advocacy work, because the people who've advocated for this from the beginning really have been working on it for a long time.
Some other news happened this week as well. On the same day the trains were first rolling out of South Coast Rail, the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel had its regular meeting. This group is keeping an eye on the decommissioning of the former Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth. Some news came out of this about the contaminated water that's being held on site. Tell us about this.
Right. So this is about draining of this water, which is radioactive, from some parts of the plant into a different area. Next month, roughly half of the water that's left in the plant right now, it's a little over 800,000 gallons. About half of that will be drained from the reactor cavity and the dryer separator pit into another area that's called the torus, T-O-R-U-S. And that is a more enclosed space. It has just a couple of hatches for access. So that means there will be less of that evaporation that people have been so concerned about. Again, that radioactive water evaporating into the outdoor air. But the company that owns Pilgrim says they have not calculated how much the reduction in evaporation would be. And the other half of the water will stay where it is, which is in the spent fuel pool. That's where the water is actually shielding workers from radiation from items that are in that water.
And this water, of course, is kind of at the center of a lot of contention, with the company Holtec looking to discharge this water eventually and seeking a permit for that. And that is an ongoing discussion. There was also an interesting back and forth about the larger mission of this group, which has been meeting for years, and which really provides this group provides us and the public the clearest view into what's happening at the power plant.
Yeah, so the panel was having a discussion this time about what items to put on future agendas. They have a new chair, Kevin Canty of Plymouth. He's a select board member, and he was quite clear with them that he wants these conversations about the agendas to be held out in the open to avoid any potential violation of the open meeting law. So they were discussing these agenda items, and it's kind of a window into people's priorities. One member of the panel, James Lampert, said the most important issue for this group is the potential safety risk from long-term storage of spent nuclear fuel. Remember, that fuel is going to be stored on the Pilgrim site even after the plant is demolished. It's going to be stored there indefinitely. Jack Priest from the State Department of Public Health, however, disagreed with that as the top priority. He said that the panel should really be focused on getting the Pilgrim plant decommissioned and getting the land turned over to the town of Plymouth. So, yeah, there are some philosophical differences there. And it was interesting to kind of see some of those nuances, because the state, you know, the Department of Public Health, of course, representing the state there, the state opposes Holtec's plan to discharge the radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay, but it does not necessarily mean the state is in line with everything that the community activists would prioritize.
A lot more to come. CAI's Jeanette Barnes, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We will take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff, and we'll hear from Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. 5 months after a secretive meeting about a controversial plan for a machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod, we now have details on what was said behind closed doors. CAI's Eve Zukoff has covered this story extensively. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
So this meeting between the Massachusetts Army National Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency, it happened back in October. And since then, several times you have been on this program and mentioned how much you really wanted to know what was discussed behind those closed doors. Now we know. First of all, tell us what the meeting was about and how you came to get the details.
Okay, but first I just want to defend my right to be professionally nosy. This all begins actually in April 2023. I'm going to take us back there for a moment, when the EPA releases this draft finding that the machine gun range that the Army Guard has proposed to build at Joint Base Cape Cod could contaminate the region's drinking water for more than 100 100,000 year-round residents and create a significant public health concern. That report was largely responsible for dooming the Range project. The Guard challenged the report, wanted a meeting with the EPA to go through really the fine points in depth. So in October, the Guard, the EPA, and a range of independent subject matter experts met to talk over the disputed points. And we knew at that time it was going to be moderated by the National Academy of Sciences, but that day-long meeting was held behind closed doors, as you said, and afterwards, there was no post-mortem report, there was no public statement, no one would answer my questions about what was discussed. But a public records request submitted by the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, which has been a very vocal critic of the Range, has led to the release of a 65-page meeting transcript generated by Zoom, along with several financial documents that together offer a pretty clear window into who specifically attended the meeting, how the Guard's tense relationship with the EPA has evolved, and outstanding concerns that the Range poses.
Okay, you went through this 65-page document. You pulled out some key takeaways for us. Let's start with the heart of the matter. You learned that scientists who do not work for the EPA, who were there, were also concerned about impacts the Range could pose to the environment.
Yes, and to be more specific, EPA officials in their report criticized what the Guard said about whether copper from the machine gun fire could make its way through groundwater and into the Cape's drinking water. The EPA described the Guard's copper study as, these are all in quotes, inconclusive, missing samples, and having incomplete analyses of contaminants of concern. The Guard has defended their process adamantly, but said, look, if you have concerns, let's redo the tests. Let's actually work together. So at the meeting in October, both groups largely maintained their original positions, while independent experts voiced their own concerns. So here's a range of them. Chris Griggs, who studies environmental chemistry for the Army Corps of Engineers, said, quote, I would treat the copper study like a report that needs major revisions. Kurt Pennell, a groundwater remediation expert from Brown University, said, I wasn't too thrilled with the lab studies, to be honest with you. And Lynn Katz, a geochemist from the University of Texas, agreed. She said it had a lot of areas that raised concerns. So lots of disciplines, a lot of concerns.
And at stake here, again, we keep pointing back to this, is the fact that this would be over the aquifer, which provides drinking water to 200,000-plus homes and businesses on the Cape. So if there are questions and concerns, it indicates some uncertainty about the safety of the aquifer facing this. Another thing that came up was the possibility that the Guard and the EPA could actually maybe work together to study the potential impacts on that aquifer. Is that going to happen?
Well, several times throughout the meeting, Guard officials pushed for the opportunity to work with the EPA to resolve their key disputes over the environmental impacts of the proposed range. Colonel Bagaglio, Joint Base Cape Cod's installation commander, said, quote, we as the Guard are open to any kind of collaboration or further discussion or whatever that is. I know we've had one meeting since, or two actually, but we've received some input. We gave some back. I don't know how collaborative that whole process was, but we're more than willing to keep engaging. And then Ken Moraff, EPA New England director, said, we thought this would be a good opportunity, this panel, and then follow up towards including possibly a consensus study. But he added, we're a little unclear on where the project stands, and we aren't quite sure what the collaborative path is. Then some of the independent experts offered specific ways to study the issues and get key answers. But crucially, no official decision is reflected in that transcript about whether a consensus study would actually be taken on.
So the Guard sounding very open to something like that. Did you get a sense that the Guard is frustrated by the EPA that they have issued, that they issued this draft report and it contributed to the downfall of a project that really the Guard has worked on for over a decade?
Well, we know from prior reporting that the Guard has been frustrated with the EPA. I will say this is a transcript. There's no tone here to be able to read. But yeah, just to remind people, the EPA's draft report really set the fall of this range in motion. In September 2024, using her authority as Commander-in-Chief of the Massachusetts Army National Guard, Governor Marhealy blocked the Guard from signing a building contract for the proposed range, which effectively ended it there, at least under current leadership and for the foreseeable future. Now, one key rationale for Healy's decision, according to a statement from her office, was the fact that the EPA's environmental review remained incomplete. That point really worried Guard officials. So Colonel Sean Cody said, quote, now people are Now people are going to say, well, the EPA didn't think that machine gun range should be built, so let's get rid of the other ranges. So he called basically this whole process with the EPA, quote, an existential threat.
Taking a big step back here and looking at the large picture, do you think that this moves the needle on this range ever coming to getting built at all?
Neither the Guard nor EPA has released any public statements about what's happened since that October meeting. But in the last 2 months, I will say the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the EPA could make it even less certain that the public will ever see a final report about the impacts of the proposed range. And the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, the folks that, filed the public records request to get this transcript in the first place, they see it this way. They basically say unless the Guard tries to revive the range project, this meeting transcript is an interesting final chapter to a long story that proves that questions remained unanswered about the project's risks and impacts. But they also said, if the Guard tries to revive the project, then these proceedings are a starting point for what additional studies are needed.
We do have a link to that full transcript, 65 pages, on our website. There's some rain in the forecast. If anyone wants to download it, you can curl up with it on the sofa. Another story this week, Eve, you talked with the former head of NOAA Fisheries about what the deconstruction of that agency could mean. That appears to be what's happening under the Trump administration. Tell us, what did you hear from her?
Yeah, so I spoke with the former head of NOAA Fisheries. She was a political appointee under President Joe Biden. Her name's Janet Coit. And she said mass layoffs across the agency, about 1,200 people so far, and 1,100 on the way, likely. They make her worried about the future of fishing. She said, we know these hundreds of federal fisheries employees who were fired under the Trump administration were in charge of setting catch limits. They were studying ocean conditions. They were opening fisheries. Again, this is all part of the Trump administration's efforts to downsize the government. But again, Janet Coit, who left her job in January, says she is worried that these staff reductions will lead to less information, which will lead to more conservative fishing quotas. So she said, I think that lack of information is going to manifest in an economic loss for the fishing sector, and a lot of them are on the margin already, particularly in New England. She was also worried about the broader impact on how long it will take to get high-performing people back in government. She worried that NOAA, and as a result, Americans and the economy will be impacted by this Trump administration mass layoff effort for decades.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, we know you're working on a larger story about federal workers who were fired under the Trump administration last month. We'll look forward to hearing your reporting maybe next time. Eve, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
As we are approaching April, summer is not far off, not as far off as we might imagine, especially if you're in the property rental business. And right now, summer rentals on Martha's Vineyard appear to be down compared to previous years. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to explain what we know about what's going on here. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
You spoke with some vineyard vacation rental agents, and it's kind of surprising what they told you about the number of openings still available for the summer.
Yeah, it was kind of, the rental market business here on the Vineyard, Nantucket on the Cape, is obviously big business, tens of thousands of dollars kind of on some properties every week. And they, talking with a lot of the people this week, they said, we're seeing a lot of openings in July and August, which are kind of our, obviously the busiest months of the year.
July and August, this is not something that would typically be still open this time of year.
Yeah, in the past, and especially kind of during the pandemic, basically everything would be booked. Some people would say, if something was a cancellation, it could literally be scooped up within an hour or two. This is kind of something weird that people were kind of noticing. One person said, business is steady, it's not booming, but we've kind of been booming for so long that steady seems like a little bit of a kind of a step back.
Now, we know that the rental market it's such a big business for the island, but also it signifies kind of what the summer economy, which is so vital to the island, it could look like. it was, we reached kind of a peak. People keep pointing back to the pandemic, saying that was kind of maybe the top of a bubble. Does this represent more of an adjustment back to something that might be a new reality?
Yeah, I think people kind of saw that as this kind of artificial peak that we wouldn't have reached otherwise. You know, international travel wasn't allowed. Kind of people kind of sought refuge in places where they felt comfortable and were kind of isolated out here. So this seems like it's all kind of part of the great readjustment back to kind of where we were prior. In the past, agents have told me, you know, prices usually rise about 2% every year, but between 2019 and 2024, a three-bedroom, the average price for one company that has a lot of properties out here, they said their clients had raised the rates 52% in that time period. So it does seem like we're kind of shifting back, kind of getting back to where we might actually should be at.
There are some other forces at work here, too. Both one of the things you point to is the number of rentals that are now on the market, and then maybe the larger political climate.
Yeah, so talking to a lot of people, kind of they saw the reasons why we have these openings in July and August is kind of the volatility of the economy right now. People might be a little nervous to kind of splurge a little bit. They also were kind of just the cost of rentals is kind of played into it. And then the sheer number of rentals that have kind of come onto the market here on the Vineyard. I believe a couple years ago in 2022, there was about 2,200 off the top of my head. Now there's like a little more than 4,000 short-term rentals registered with the state on the Vineyard. Some of those may have been short-term rentals before, then just maybe hadn't registered. But so there might be the same amount of people coming to the Vineyard. But because there's just so many short-term rental properties on the island now, maybe they're just not all getting filled.
I wonder how much this translates into a feeling of concern on the island or whether there's a sense that as summer approaches, these will start to fill in, that the people looking around right now will finally lock in and say, all right, let's we can't go a summer without getting to the Vineyard.
Yeah, I mean, not everyone has said business is slow. One company did tell me that one of the larger companies, too, said we've seen business kind of actually bookings are up 10%. One phenomenon that a lot of agents have started to notice in the past couple of years is customers are starting to haggle a little more, which maybe they're trying to get a better deal kind of a little closer to the summer. They're asking for kind of shorter stays instead of kind of the traditional 1 week vacation rental or kind of a different turnover day. So I think a lot of people are kind of hopeful that, you know, this will fill out. And even if it's not, it's still pretty steady out here.
That is Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
What happens when low-income older people aren't able to keep up with the property taxes on their homes? Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with the story of one town trying to figure out how to help. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Chatham at Springtown Meeting, voters will consider a petition article to establish a fund to help in these instances. Tell us a little bit about how this came about.
Sure. Local resident Seth Taylor, who's actually a former selectman, he submitted a petition article to ask the town to pay the taxes, the overdue property taxes of an elderly resident here in town who just couldn't keep up with her tax bill. It had accumulated to something like $60,000, and she would just never be able to keep up with it. And he wanted the town to pay that. But town council ruled that there's a state prohibition against using direct taxpayer funds to pay to an individual or resident. So while Mr. Taylor disagreed with that ruling, he went and submitted a second petition article. And this one seeks to adopt a state law that allows a town to create what's called a taxation aid fund, whereby funds can be accumulated to help pay the property taxes of low-income, elderly, and disabled residents. Wellfleet has a similar program in place. I think they're the only town, other town on the Cape that has it at this time. But basically, under this provision of the state law, that the town would basically just have to vote to accept in a majority vote, a taxation aid committee would be established, which would oversee this fund. Residents would be able to either, you know, check a box on their tax bill or include an extra amount in their tax bill specifically designated to go into this fund. And then this committee, which would be made up of the chairman of the Board of Assessors, the town treasurer, and three residents appointed by the select board, they would sort of review tax situations that were brought to them that could benefit from this this fund.
I'm curious, if they're reviewing these tax situations that are brought to them, as you say, does that become public knowledge then? Is to apply for that kind of assistance from the town, is it that force you out into the public for people who might be reluctant?
Yeah, there was some concern about that among board members of the Board of Selectmen. And theoretically, this committee would have to abide by the state open meeting law. But like the Board of Assessors, for instance, when they're considering tax abatements, can go into executive session so as not to to reveal details of individual taxpayers' situations. Mr. Taylor suggested that this committee could do something like that, and that the records would that were brought up in public would not have to be specific to an individual taxpayer. That basically the resident, you know, this committee could report to the Board of Selectmen or maybe town meeting every year, and you know, basically say we gave out this much money to this many taxpayers and you know, took care of their tax liability in this fashion.
And the select board seems to be in favor of this proposal.
Yeah, the select board now the select board did not back Mr. Taylor's initial petition, but they did vote unanimously in favor of this proposal. They also did not support a third petition that Mr. Taylor submitted, which would allow anyone on town meeting floor to designate some of the town's free cash for this taxation fund. Town council again here said that he had concerns about this because it it could handicap the use of free cash for other reasons. So the selectmen aren't going to support that, but all three articles are going to go before town meeting because they were petition articles. And in the meantime, another local resident has started a GoFundMe campaign to try to address the situation of the original situation that Mr. Taylor was concerned about. The resident who had fallen way behind on her taxes.
Hey, Tim, let me ask you about another story in the paper this week. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke about Chatham considering a townwide speed limit to address, I guess, what many considered this growing number of cars driving too fast for the town roads. Now the town, it appears, is moving off that idea. Explain what's happening.
Sure. Initially, you know, concern over speeding on town roads, both in the summer and during the off season, prompted a proposal that areas that are designated as thickly settled, you know, we've all seen those yellow thickly settled signs around. Right now, those zones are designated at a 30 mile an hour speed limit. There's a state law that could be adopted by a town meeting that would allow the town to set a lower speed limit for those areas. And, you know, thickly settled areas are defined as locations along a road where there's a business or a home or a building basically every 200 feet. And, you know, that's basically all of Chatham. So the idea was to impose a 25 mile an hour speed limit on the entire town, except for state. This would not apply to state highways like Route 28. But instead of doing that, the select board decided to take a more targeted approach. You know, we've all seen those LED speed signs around posted on roads that say, you know, they flash when you're going faster than the speed limit, or they turn red. Chatham has a few of those around, and select board members felt that those do a good job of calming traffic, of reminding drivers that they need to slow down. So what they decided to do instead of the 25 mile an hour speed limit is to seek about $66,000 at town meeting next month to purchase more of those sort of stationary LED electronic speed signs, plus a couple of portable ones. Now the permanent ones would be placed in specific places where there's always a speeding problem, and the portable ones could be used on various town roads around town, both during the season and during the off season.
Let me jump in here. Kind of interesting that to put these temporary speed limit signs around is actually going to be less expensive by their estimate than trying to create a townwide speed limit that's lower.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that the DPW estimated that to change all of the speed limit signs around town would cost about $80,000, both in material and labor, because, you know, they'd have to put their men out there. You know, there's a lot of speed limit signs around, and this alternative would cost, as I said, about $66,000 for about a dozen new electronic speed signs. So it is less expensive. And they selectmen feel it's going to be more effective. And, you know, they figured the alternative is if this doesn't do the job, you know, they can always go back to the first the first plan.
That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. A budget resolution that could strip as much as $880 billion from Medicaid over the next decade passed the U.S. House in February, raising the prospect of large cuts in the mass health program. Like so much of what is happening in Washington, D.C. these days, this could have a big impact for us right here on the Cape. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent has the story and joins us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Start, I guess, by explaining these cuts and then take us a little bit through how this money largely works its way from the federal government to the state and down into our local community.
The final number isn't set because the Senate will have to do their own budget bill. But this is a reconciliation bill that can go through Congress with only half of the Senate. It can't be filibustered. So it could pass with only Republican votes. The Massachusetts delegation wouldn't really have any influence. So the Kaiser Family Foundation analyzed how these cuts would actually look if applied to the state. And if you just make it even across every state and across all 10 years, which is a hypothetical, you come out to $2 billion out of Massachusetts' share of Medicaid funding every year for the next 10 years.
Mm. And the Massachusetts share of that is going into funding mass health, which covers a significant portion of the population here on the Cape.
Yeah, about a quarter of the state is on mass health. And that $2 billion, to put it in context, that's about 16% of what the feds send to Massachusetts for mass health. It's also double what the state is raising with its new millionaire's tax, the 4% surcharge on incomes over $1 million. So $2 billion is a lot. You don't just sort of find it under the couch cushions. It's a really significant share of what the state has to spend on Medicaid. So that means that there could be really significant cuts to the MassHealth program. Many times that comes through eligibility narrowing, which just knocks people out of the program entirely because it's difficult to cut services that are required by law.
There, your article points to a couple of changes that they could potentially consider in order to try to narrow that. You talk about eligibility narrowing. Explain a little bit specifically what they're talking about there.
One of them would be work requirements, which a lot of their effectiveness just comes from the paperwork that's involved and people failing to get the paperwork done. But also, there's a proposal on the table to require you to verify your income every 6 months to stay on MassHealth, which also would be, I mean, again, this is coming from Congress, not the state, but that would also create a lot of paperwork that people tend to fail to do. You miss the stuff that's in the mail. You don't realize that you haven't kept yourself up to date on the program. And when you go to the doctor, it turns out you're not covered.
So essentially, to save money, they're going to make it harder to access those services, hoping that people fall away.
Yes.
Another thing that you point to here, which particularly I think has potential impacts for the Cape, and but for a lot of areas, is that these cuts will impact the health services that, like the Outer Cape Health Services provides, the community health services that are providing services to the community here, that they are particularly in jeopardy.
Yeah, Outer Cape Health Services and also the similar organizations in Falmouth and on the islands, they have to cover anyone who approaches them because they're federally qualified community health centers. So they have to cover uninsured people, which obviously is expensive because the sliding scale that they offer to uninsured people, you know, doesn't cover the full cost of care. So when people lose MassHealth coverage and show up as uninsured instead, they can still get care, but that care becomes a lot more expensive for Outer Cape Health to absorb. So that's a really serious threat to their bottom line.
There is one more wrinkle here, which I had never heard about, that your article drills down on, which I think is fascinating, which is that the way these community health services now operate, they negotiate their insurance reimbursements with the different insurance providers like Boston Medical Center and Blue Cross Blue Shield, Tufts, and also with MassHealth. But the reimbursement rate that they're getting from the commercial insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield is significantly lower right now than it is from MassHealth. And that's really a crimping the way that the community health centers can provide health services to the communities.
I was also really surprised to learn that employer-offered insurance with these, you know, brand names on them like Tufts and BMC are in fact reimbursing Outer Cape Health at a half to a third of what MassHealth and Medicare are paying Outer Cape Health. So the director of the organization said, effectively, the state and the feds are helping pay for the profit margins of these companies because they're offering so much more to Outer Cape Health Services that keeps the organization going, and Tufts and BMC are paying them so much less than the state and the feds are.
Explain why that's happening.
They're state-regulated, so it is kind of fascinating that it happens, but you know, they negotiate separately with each of these health provider systems, and the ones that are based around hospitals have a lot more negotiating power. So according to Jamie Archer, the CEO of Outer Cape Health Services, the hospital-based organizations are able to negotiate much better reimbursements from Tufts, BMC, Blue Cross, than your smaller organizations like the community health centers that serve the Outer Cape or Falmouth or the islands.
I know there's some legislation that's pending on all of this. There's a lot of information in your article. I encourage folks to go to the Provincetown Independent and take a look at it. That is Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. The National Transportation Safety Board called out the Bourne and Sagamore bridges by name in a recent report about the vulnerability of the nation's bridges. CAI's Gilda Geist has this story and more. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Steve.
The report focused on the risk of collapse from a boat collision, and this comes out of the investigation into the tragic collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge last year.
Yeah, so just to remind folks what happened with that bridge, the one-year anniversary was just this week, actually. There was this huge cargo ship that was traveling toward the bridge on its way out of the port of Baltimore. It lost power and, as a result, ended up crashing into the bridge, killing six construction workers and setting off a cascade of economic impacts. So the National Board of Transportation Safety, which is an independent U.S. government agency, basically did this big investigation, and the chair of the board, Jennifer Homendy, presented the results of the investigation in a press conference last week. And you could tell in the video that she was frustrated, largely because the report found that this accident was preventable. Had the Maryland Transportation Authority kept up with regularly assessing the bridge's risk of collapse in the event of a vessel strike, Homendy said, they would have found that the risk was way too high. And had officials in Maryland known that, they could have proactively worked to make the bridge safer before disaster struck.
So this report included a list of bridges around the country that have not been assessed for a similar risk of collapse from collision. The Cape bridges are on that list.
Yes, they were among the 68 bridges on that list, and these are bridges that see a lot of vessel traffic and that haven't recently had a vessel strike risk assessment done, as laid out by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, also known as AASHTO. So this is an organization that has for decades been putting out best practices and safety standards that bridge owners should be following. And they have a formula for how to calculate a bridge's risk of collapse in the event of a vessel strike, and they have guidance on how often these risk assessments should be done. Now, just because our bridges are on this list does not mean they're going to collapse. What it means is that the bridges have not undergone AASHTO's risk assessment in a long time, and what that means is basically that we don't know how likely it is that these bridges would collapse in the event of a vessel strike.
And the Bourne and the Sagamore, both of which are due to be replaced eventually, are owned and maintained by the federal government, by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, so I reached out to the Army Corps, and they said they were still reviewing the report and that safety is their priority. And I didn't hear much from them beyond that. One thing we do know, the Enterprise reported this recently, the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, or MassDOT, issued a statement that says after the bridge collapse in Baltimore, Governor Mara Healey sat down with experts from MassDOT, the Coast Guard, Mass Maritime, to discuss potential similar risks to our bridges here in Massachusetts. And apparently, that group confirmed that the risk of collapse due to vessel strike for our bridges is low. Did they use the AASHTO formula, as the report from the Transportation Board urgently recommended? We don't know. But at the end of the day, the responsibility to do that falls to the Army Corps, according to the report.
Another story that you covered this week, the district attorney for the Cape and Islands and Cape Cod Healthcare are teaming up to create better follow-up care for people dealing with overdoses or mental health crises. And what's interesting here is that the point of leverage is actually a database. It's not what we typically think of in these kinds of efforts.
Yeah, so this is a database called the Critical Incident Management System, or CIMS. And the idea is basically that it connects law enforcement with social services organizations that specialize in things like addiction and recovery or behavioral health issues. So if a 911 call comes in for someone overdosing, CIMS makes it easy for law enforcement to log key data into this system, and then the social services orgs can use that data to make decisions about how and when and whether to follow up with the individual to make sure they get connected to the care or whatever resources they might need.
This is going to be part of a 4-year effort?
Yes, Cape Cod Healthcare pledged $1 million for this project, and that will come in $250,000 chunks over the next 4 years. And that'll pay for stuff like the licensing fee to use CIMS, trainings for law enforcement and social services organizations, and personnel costs for managing this system. And then when the 4 years are up, the district attorney's office is hoping they can start working to expand this to the islands.
Okay, before we let you go, one more story you brought us this week. It was from Falmouth High School. It was about a special workshop event for students designed to build social and emotional connections with each other. This is called Challenge Day.
Yeah, so like you said, Challenge Day is a social emotional learning workshop. It's offered by a company that takes this program around the world, including to Falmouth. The workshop's an all-day thing. It basically starts with games and team-building challenges, fun stuff like that. But then, as the day goes on, the students are given more and more opportunities to open up to each other. One example of this was the exercise the kids were calling the Over the Line Challenge. It's basically picture this big line of masking tape along the floor of the gym. And then you have the adults running the workshop reading out different experiences and statements. And if you step over the line, that means you've experienced that or you relate to those statements. From what I've been told, this was really popular with the kids because they were able to address some really tough stuff in their lives that as teenagers, they might not have known how to talk about, all without having to use words.
I thought what was interesting here is that when you spoke with some of the students who participated, you heard a lot of positive feedback.
Yeah, every student who agreed to talk to me for this story was super into Challenge Day. They were saying things like, you know, they felt closer to their classmates, they met new people, they had a better understanding of how to be kind to their peers, and they got to open up about things that were really weighing on them.
You can hear that story on our website. That's capeandislands.org. It's a great feature. That's CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank all our guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and CAI's Gilda Geist. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.